listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2015 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. In one of his last interviews with Studs Terkel, the writer James Baldwin referred to, quote, "the bill this country is going to have to pay. Bills always do come in." Baldwin also reminded us, quote, "there's never time in the future in which we will work out our salvation. The challenge is in the moment. The time is always now." And I'm glad that in this moment we have Ta-Nehisi Coates and Robin Kelly with us tonight, and I'm glad that you're all here for what I'm sure is going to be a very compelling conversation. And after our guest's conversation, we will take some questions from you. We won't be able to get to all of them, and we ask that you wait until the microphone comes to you, as we do record for podcast. And I want to stress that we really do ask that you ask a question, not several questions, not a statement. It would be really appreciated by all of us. All copies of Ta-Nehisi's book, Between the World and Me, are pre-signed and are available for sale courtesy of our library store tonight. He's not able to stay afterwards for a book signing. Ta-Nehisi Coates, writer, journalist, and educator, is also a senior editor for The Atlantic, where he writes about culture, politics, and social issues. His essay, The Case for Reparations, provocatively traces the history of racism in the U.S. from slavery to recent examples of housing discrimination. This much-lauded piece, which is just an amazing read, set a single-day traffic record for a magazine article on The Atlantic's website and is probably the most discussed magazine piece of the Obama era, and if you haven't read it, do. In The Case for Reparations, Coates calls on the nation, calls on us, to have the bravery to face the truth. More important than any single check cut to any African American, he writes, the payment of reparations would represent America's maturation out of the childhood myth of its innocence into a wisdom worthy of its founders. How would culture have to change in order to make the sort of reckoning he calls for possible? What sort of cultural forces might it take to make those enormous shifts? I think the Los Angeles Public Library is a very good place to discuss those questions. Coates' new book, Between the World and Me, addressed to his 14-year-old son, echoes the directive and provocative prose of James Baldwin. He writes to his son, quote, "White America is a syndicate arrayed to protect its exclusive power to dominate and control our bodies." The New York Times' A.O. Scott called the book essential, like water or air. Ta-Nehisi Coates was born in 1975. He grew up in Northwest Baltimore into a family infused with Black political consciousness. His father, Paul Coates, had been a Black Panther. He became a radical librarian. I just love that term. An independent publisher. He writes about his childhood in his first book, a memoir, The Beautiful Struggle. He writes about growing up with his head deep in comic books. We may hear more about comic books tonight. And Malcolm X's speech on his Walkman. And in conversation with Ta-Nehisi tonight is Robin D.G. Kelly, award-winning author and leading African-American studies scholar. His research and interests have focused on the African diaspora, urban studies, working-class radicalism, and cultural history with an emphasis on music. He's currently Distinguished Professor of History and Gary B. Nash Endowed Chair in U.S. History at UCLA. And among his many fabulous books are Thelonious Monk, The Life and Times of an American Original, and Freedom Dreams, The Black Radical Imagination, which we have on sale tonight. And his most recent book is Africa Speaks, America Answers, Modern Jazz in Revolutionary Times. Please welcome Ta-Nehisi Coates and Robin Kelly to the Aloud stage.
Got two pillows to be high enough. That's how you do it. Ah, yes. Okay. Yeah, and I'm the elder, you know? Yeah. Anyway, it's such a pleasure and honor to be sitting here with Ta-Nehisi. I'm surprised we haven't met because our circles have a lot of people in common. Howard University is a place I spent a lot of time, not as a student, but giving lectures and you know, spending a lot of time at the Moreland Spingarn collection doing research for my dissertation. And then he ends up in New York City when I was at NYU again, and was interesting about this. Ta-Nehisi began writing for Village Voice at a really crucial moment. I mean, everyone was impressed with his writing and amazed, but he came in pretty much 3 years after Joe Wood had disappeared. And Joe Wood, if you know anything about him, was an incredibly talented writer, 34 years old, disappeared on Mount Rainier. And he was the writer for Village Voice. So in some ways, Ta-Nehisi was seen as the person to replace him, and one of the few who actually could rise to the occasion.
Do you know what happened to him?
Oh, he literally disappeared. I mean, he was hiking and fell into a hole.
Oh, my God.
And was swept by the current of ice, and many people, Mount Rainier that year, had died as a result.
Wow. Wow.
And Joe was a very close friend of mine. He edited Malcolm X in Our Own Image. So your columns and your edgy humor in some ways gave us comfort. Mm-hmm. His book, The Beautiful Struggle, should be read by all of you. Don't just, you know, you need to buy The Beautiful Struggle in addition to Between the World and Me. You have to. And we'll talk a little bit about that.
You must. Do it.
You know, because that book shows he's a gifted memoirist, has something to say. And I'm gonna bring it up a little later in our conversation. So, you know, all these years we've been kind of swirling around each other, you know, dealing with some of the same issues. And Between the World and Me kind of wedged your ongoing self-exploration with issues central to your journalistic work, you know, race, policing, slavery, reparations, history. And it's a book written with a kind of urgency. And so what I want to do is treat our conversation with that same urgency, mm-hmm. To really raise critical questions and try to advance a conversation. So in other words, your book tour is preempted. Mm-hmm. Now it's time for some real challenging questions. So let's begin with a very basic one. I know that James Baldwin's The Fire Next Time has been an inspiration, and you've talked about this story. But in writing this book, what was your objective? What did you want to accomplish?
Well, I mean, before that, I just have to say that I am deeply honored to be here with the great Robin Kelly. When I was in undergrad at Howard, and on what turned out to be a chaotic mission to be a poet or a historian, Robin was a particular influence in a kind of way. That was an era, and I promise I'm not ducking.
Okay.
I'm not trying to flatter you, make the interview easier. But no, it's really true. I was telling Robin this. There is a tradition of intellectuals who came up during that period, very prominent during that period, and they engaged the media in a particular way. On TV, you know, just talking a lot. I guess that's the best way to put it. I'm looking for a way to finesse that, but talking a lot. And Robin didn't talk, he wrote. And even though I find myself in a period now where I talk a lot, I am reminded every time that I shouldn't be talking right now. You know, it's like Miles said, I should be home practicing right now instead of talking to you guys. That's what Robin would be doing.
Yeah,
you know?
But you got a book. You got a book to bring to us, you know? So you're right.
You gotta hustle. But I just say that he is mm-hmm. an example for us, you know? Really, really is. And so I just wanted to say it's such an honor. I mean, I never thought this would happen, you know, 20 years ago when I was at Howard. What I want to get across, I was telling Robin this backstage, we talked a little bit, and I was saying that, you know, I read The Fire Next Time, and to me, The Fire Next Time, though I think for a lot of people who read it, it stands out, you know, for its politics, I always saw it as a work of art, okay? Because I read that book when I was probably about 18 years old. I was sitting in Founders Library at Howard. I think The Fire Next Time might be 110, 120 pages or something like that. And it just hit me, and I didn't even know what it was about. I mean, I had a rough idea, but if I had to, you know, really take The Fire Next Time apart at that age, I really, really couldn't have done it. Much like when I was a kid and I would hear certain hip-hop albums, and I couldn't really tell you what was going on. I couldn't tell you every reference Chuck D was making. I didn't have all of it. Much like, you know, you encounter any great piece of art, and a lot of times it's emotional. The way I would encounter, say, Ginsberg's Howl, And it was emotional. Even I didn't know what Ginsberg was, you know, really referring to, you know. But the words made me feel a certain way. That was how I came to the fire next time, and that was what I took away from it. Years later, I reread it, and then I got to politics. And when I got to politics and I got to art, I said, oh, my God. You know, I think this is easily, you know, one of the greatest works in nonfiction ever written. And I called my agent and I said, you know, why don't people write like this anymore? And I had the same conversation with my editor. And the answer was that you know, Baldwin was one of a kind, and he was. Mm-hmm. Well, we decided to take on that challenge. At the same time, one has to have something to communicate, you know? And so I think, like, I had done all of this journalism, and I'm continuing, you know, to do journalism like this that just tries to give you what the architecture of white supremacy is here. So you take housing, for instance. Here's, you know, how you can see the map. And then you can interlock that with, you know, incarceration, as I tried to do recently. And, you know, hopefully as I go on, you know, throughout my career, you have inner layers. And hopefully at some point you'll be able to see the entire atlas of it, the map. And you can see how, like a web, you know, it affects every aspect of our life. That's my working theory. And I'm just, you know, going through, you know, the journalism, trying to see if that's true, trying to test out that theory. But one of the things that I was frustrated with was that, you know, that kind of writing, I think, can make racism, make the weight of white supremacy too abstract. The job of literature is to convey the force, the weight, the pain, you know, of a system of oppressive forces in the most personal and direct way possible. At least that's one job of literature. I always thought that was what Baldwin mm-hmm. did. That was what I wanted for this book to communicate to you. I wanted you to see racism and white supremacy not as an abstract evil, but as an actual thing that is personal within the lives of African Americans, that takes years off your life, that raises your blood pressure, that changes how you interact with the world in the most smallest but yet the most critical ways. I just wanted people to feel the weight, the visceral feeling of the weight of white supremacy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, you don't at all deny the link to Baldwin, even though in the book itself, you don't really reference Baldwin much. You have an epigraph mm-hmm. of Baldwin. You mention him once in reference to thinking about Paris. Mm-hmm. And not that you have to, but right. because of that... Because you didn't sort of spell out your relationship right. or what you take from Baldwin. Again, you don't have to.
Right.
It has opened a door for all these kind of, I think, ill-informed mm-hmm. comparisons mm-hmm. between your work and The Fire Next Time. And one of those comparisons revolve around the sort of alleged lack of hope mm-hmm. in your work. Mm-hmm. Now, you and I both know that you're not required to have hope. No, that's not a requirement. Right. You don't need to have that. And... I just wanted to sort of say a couple things. I mean, the book, in fact, comes, for me, philosophically, is much closer to Baldwin's project in many ways. You know, it's, in spite of Baldwin's religiosity, this is a book about a rejection, in mm-hmm. some ways, of Christianity. It is, despite your disavowal of redemption narratives, it's not as if Baldwin is very clear that there's a redemption mm-hmm. narrative here. Mm-hmm. And then you have all these other things in common, and you both love Malcolm X. Mm-hmm. You know, people don't realize that Baldwin wasn't a big fan of King's. Mm-hmm. He preferred Malcolm, mm-hmm. you know, over this. He also said, you know, I love this quote, Baldwin said, you know, he understood the West's relationship to the rest of us as one of plunder. In an interview, he said, the bankruptcy of the Western world is simply the end of the possibilities of plunder. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. there are many ways in which you all on a very similar path, much closer, but you part ways. Mm-hmm. Tell me how you see yourself both drawing on Baldwin's tradition,
right.
but specifically how you see yourself parting ways.
Well, let's just start with where you started with this question of hope. The notion that art or journalism or science or history or anything is that it must be hopeful. Is ridiculous and absurd and infantile. What if, you know, you know Joan Didion was here having a conversation with you, and at the end of which you said, yes, but I don't find your literature very hopeful. that would be, you know, the audience would look at that right. person like, are you out of your mind?
Right.
If I finished The Great Gatsby and said, well, I really wanted Nick and Daisy to get together at the end. Sorry, Jay, Gatsby and Daisy to get together at the end. Why didn't that happen? I don't know how to feel about this. You know, I finished The Grapes of Wrath. Why didn't everything end up great for the Joads? I don't quite get it. I came up on hip-hop. Hip-hop was the literature of my youth. And hip-hop lives in the muck of humanity and in what can't happen. There's so many scenes that I think about. I was thinking about this on the train today. There's this love song that the Roots have. And the guy is, you know, in the first verse, and he's talking about when he meets a Black Thought, meets this woman in Paris, and she says that, and he says that their whole outset from the beginning was, we knew from the start that things fall apart and tend to shatter. And that's like them commencing the relationship. But it's a very beautiful statement, you know, and they end up, you know, and go through the relationship anyway. And that is, you know, so much of life. People, unfortunately, and I don't know when this happened or how this happened, but have begun to confuse writers, and Black writers specifically, mm-hmm. Black writers specifically, with therapists. You know, and perhaps...
That's not new, though.
Is that not new?
That's old.
That is old. Really?
Yeah, it goes back to 1965.
Wow.
I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding.
But like, you think you're supposed to make people feel good at the end. Right. You know, yes, but can you make us feel good?
Right.
You know, and that, you know, unfortunately is, you know, that's true, you know, in Black and white community. So I just think that's an awful standard for literature, period. That's the first thing I'll say. I think you made a good point about Malcolm. I think, and I don't know, but I think, you know, obviously Baldwin disagreed a lot, you know, with Malcolm, mm-hmm. you know, especially during his death. But I think what he liked was just a kind of coldness that Malcolm would speak with. You know, just this kind of straight ahead, listen, this is what it is. Behind this is power. You know, forget love, forget whatever. This is a power situation here, period. That's what defined this relationship. And it was like, without any sentimentalism, and there's something like really, really attractive about that. You know, I can remember listening to, you know, tapes of Malcolm X as a kid. And see, what I identify now is a lack of condescension. Mm-hmm. Like, he wouldn't condescend to me. You know what I mean? It was the absolute absence in many ways of being made to feel good about a situation. Yeah, and I think Baldwin wrote like that, man. I mean, he really wrote, you know, with that kind of vigor, that kind of energy, with a cold-eyed look at everything. I mean, even in that portion of Fire Next Time where he's critiquing the nation, mm-hmm. you know, he understands why the nation has appeal. He's got it. You know, even as he's saying this is not the way ultimately, like, he really is able to see it, you know, give them their space, and then go in and critique it. And I thought, right. I want to write like that. I want to write with that coldness, that directness, right. you know, that honesty.
Right. But let me just throw something else in. I mean, that honesty is in there. I mean, when he says, you know, I don't know many Negroes who are eager to be accepted by white people and still less to be loved by them.
Yeah,
that's
the coldness. We just want you to stop beating
right.
us over the head.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's the next line after. Yeah. But then he does talk about love. And this is one of the places where I want to get you to talk about where you differ from Baldwin. I mean, for him, love is not soft. Mm-hmm. Love is hard. Mm-hmm. Love is not sentimental. Mm-hmm. But he's talking about love in a kind of agape sense. And one of the things that he says is that, you know, those who claim to be white, of course, mm-hmm. believe as well as they do and cause you to endure, speaking to his nephew, does not testify to your inferiority, but to their inhumanity and fear. For these innocent people have no other hope. They are, in effect, still trapped in a history which they do not understand. And until they understand it, they cannot be released from it. So for him, liberation as a country requires that they understand and free themselves from history.
Right.
I know at the end of the book, you tell Samori that, look, you know, you can't sort of wait on white people. But for Baldwin, it is that, you know, saying no matter how people treat you, you've got to treat them back with love, specifically white people who are in some ways, you know, unable to release themselves from that history. He's not saying you need to teach white people.
Mm-hmm.
He's not going that far. But what do you think about this idea of the interdependence?
We think he means them by treat them with love. Then, not teach them. What do you think he means?
Well, if he says, and I think he gives an example of this, there's no reason if you're in a position to be able to disparage somebody because of their race, because they represent, that you do it.
Right.
And one of the amazing things about the history of, say, Reconstruction, the end of slavery, is, and you know this better than I do, the formerly enslaved people who were never really slaves, they were just enslaved and kidnapped, mm-hmm. Focused more on building institutions and extending social democracy to the entire nation
right.
than they did on taking revenge or excluding.
Right.
And that's why you don't, I don't know the last time I saw an article about black supremacists going into a white church
right.
and blowing them up.
Right.
You know, it just doesn't happen.
Right. But you know what, I guess this is where you want to get to a place that I differ. I don't know how much of that is love and how much of that is cold, like politics.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it would not have been smart to, you know, proceed on a campaign of revenge and destruction. Like that just, I mean, right, politically, see, like how much of that was
let's take it. Let's take it back another place. Let's just talk about something as basic as free universal public education.
Right.
So much of what black legislators and elected officials right. tried to do in the 1860s right. was create democratic institutions that actually opened the door for poor white people.
True, true.
And that is a vision that's produced out of their experience. True. In other words, enslaved people had politics before right. they got their freedom.
Right, right, right. No, I agree with you. But mm-hmm. even in that, well, I would say two things. The first thing is African-Americans being Americans, mm-hmm. I think is really, really crucial in
right.
that. Like actually having an American identity. But also, I mean, how do you separate that from the cold real politic too? Of, you know, it would really be better if we had some allies in this. You know what I mean? Like it actually does help us. You know what I mean? If we can actually forge alliances right. here.
Well, true. But I guess the question is, there's so many different ways people could have proceeded that was even colder politics.
Mm.
For example, when you start to extend your political vision mm-hmm. to democratize America, to incorporate those who have been excluded,
mm-hmm.
you make yourself more vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
And so the kind of violence meted out on black people who supported Republicans and later, you know, Greenback Labor Party, mm-hmm. that kind of violence had to do with a radical politics
mm-hmm.
that was about inclusion, as opposed to saying, you know what, we're just going to make our all-black towns,
right.
and you could just leave us alone. Now, they did that, too.
Right,
that was there, too.
Right.
So I'm not, and by the way, I'm not suggesting that any of this was driven by love,
right.
but that Baldwin is saying that if I'm going to try to imagine a different possibility of liberation, I can't reproduce the same violence
right.
against me.
Right.
And that for him, and again, for Dr. King, whom he actually distrusted sometimes,
mm-hmm.
was about the constant struggle to make community. That is the definition
mm-hmm.
of love.
Mm-hmm.
To make community, even with those people who may not be as advanced as you. So when he right. says, look, I don't want to, I'm really not interested in marrying your daughter because I know your family,
right,
you know?
Right.
But if I do marry your daughter,
right.
maybe I could elevate her to my
right.
my place, you know? I mean,
yeah, you know, I think like part of this is like me coming out of, you know, the left radical and nationalist end mm-hmm. of the politics, where it's like, you have to make community.
Right, absolutely.
Like it just has to happen. There is no, I mean, one of the cool things about having the background that I have is the experience of doing all of these thought experiments, and in some cases not thought experiments, you know, figuring, okay, so if the Nationalist Project works out, is that a place where you want to live?
Mm-hmm.
You want to live? I mean, Bayard right. Rustin had that great line when he's debating Elijah Muhammad. I mean, he's debating Malcolm, and he's talking about right. what life would look like under Elijah Muhammad and whether he actually would want to right. live in that country.
Right.
And so, like, for me, it's like, no.
No.
I would be at the center.
right.
Right. Like, I mean, in that country, I probably right. would be in the same place that I am in relation
exactly.
to America. I would be dissenting against power. So then what? So
exactly.
But for me, that just feels like, and this is just me, like from my perspective, that just feels like gaming it out. Like mm-hmm. it doesn't actually have an emotional right. component or a love. I mean, love may be the result
mm-hmm.
of that, but it just feels like, well, that can't work.
Right, right.
You know?
Let me just quick, because I don't want to lose any time. But so I got this other question about fear.
Right.
And I want to talk a little bit about this because you frame much of the book around the thesis that, you know, fear governs Black life, especially the generation. And it's a very powerful, very persuasive argument. But for me, when I read that, I kind of stopped in my tracks because when I read The Beautiful Struggle, which, by the way, should have won a Pulitzer. I don't know why it didn't.
Well, thank you.
That book is amazing. Because what you did, something that no social scientist was ever successful at doing, and that is showing the full range of humanity.
Right.
The blurb on that book that suggests, you know, I guess the publicist wrote it, it's like sort of, you know, this is like, emphasizes in the age of crack. Yeah. The age of crack was background.
Yeah, it's background.
But what's so important was that you have Black boys and girls, men and women, experiencing right. every range of emotion,
right.
joy and verve and humor, despite the fear. Fear is there.
Right, right,
and you, it's not like you play it down. It's very right. much there. But see, the passages that I was moved to tears by was you in the basement spitting rhymes,
yeah, right?
You playing djembe. By the way, my son plays djembe. I didn't mention
okay,
that.
All right.
finding meaning in Nation House.
Yeah.
That your autodidacticism actually comes out of this community that's training you in ways outside of the institution of the school.
Right.
So if you can just help me. And by the way, Baldwin also, you know, insisted that it was the capacity of Black people to love each other under the constraints.
Right.
Of the threat of physical and social death.
Right.
That's the secret to survival. If you can reconcile that joy and zest that you write so beautifully about, that's in this book, by the way. It's not like it's not there.
Yeah, it's there, too.
And the idea of fear governing. Reconcile those for me.
Well, I just feel like Black people don't get enough credit for their humanity. Mm-hmm. I mean, I just... And that was... when they show you in a certain way on TV, or they show you a certain way in media over and over again, that is, you know, that is stripping you of your humanity in this really simplistic way.
Right.
And as a writer, in my small way, my contribution is to, you know, to show, you know, the depth of Black life. And so that was very much a part of what was going on in The Beautiful Struggle. I mean, the crack piece, the age of crack is background, but within that, people did not lose their humanity.
Right.
You know, they didn't, and they had a response. They had a political response. They had a cultural response that you know, is worth noting. In this book, you're right. It's much more about the fear. It's much more about the exterior forces. But, like, the parts about Howard were essential because, I mean, I don't know if I'm, you know, if this is necessary in all my work, but definitely in this book, you know, I was very interested in investigating Black identity and revealing it not to be a photo negative of white identity.
Right. Right.
But it's something very, very right. distinctive, that white identity is strictly racial. Black identity is racial in the sense that it's something that's put on you. But within that, or underneath of that, is a very vibrant ethnic, you know, identity. You know, a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful ethnic identity that is complicated, that is a stew of so many things. And see, that's the thing that the people made.
Mm-hmm.
That's what Black people made. The racial piece is what they called us, what they stamped us
imposed,
with.
Right.
But within that, there's a, you know, an entrepreneurial piece that we made. Mm-hmm. And that's, I mean, it's such a beautiful, that, you know, like this is what I argue, you know, in the book and in my interviews. This is actually the great problem, you know, with white supremacy in this country. White people have so much to lose. I mean, they have their very identity as white people to lose.
Mm-hmm.
Black people don't actually have that. In fact, Black people would cast it off in a second. I'm talking about the racial piece.
Right.
Because they have culture, they have tradition, they have all these other things to fall back on. And that's not really true of white identity. Now, there are identities underneath a white identity, you know, Jewish identity, you know, Irish American identity, you know, some folks take pride in being Californians. Like, there are all these other things beneath it. But white identity itself, I mean, the destruction of white supremacy is the destruction of white people as a construct.
Right. Right.
Not people with blonde hair or light skin. You understand what I'm saying?
Right.
I mean, we got that too. You know what I mean? The Black identity.
Right.
You know, but the destruction of the concept of it, you know?
Exactly. It was this one quote that...
And this is the hard part, by the way. I mean, that to me, I think, is the tough part that people have not, you know, quite grappled with.
Right, right. No, I mean, it's true. And I was wondering about, in terms of what constitutes white identity, which, of course, is, as you argue, built on plunder, is also built on ideology,
right?
Which, you know, underwrites that level of plunder. But it's one where Baldwin talks about is a kind of fear.
Mm-hmm.
That's always there, and it's very fragile. Mm-hmm. It's amazing how fragile it is, mm-hmm. which is why when you talked about the entrepreneurial side of Black culture, one of the interesting things that happens, of course, is the constant appropriation and enveloping and costuming of mm-hmm. Blackness
mm-hmm.
as a way of achieving some kind of sense of self.
Right.
You know, which is the whole history of Mitchell Street all about.
I mean, you think about all of our humor. Like, you know, ha, 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 you know, oh, I'm so white. I mean, what you're saying is, like, I don't have anything except power. That's what the statement is.
Right.
I mean, that's what all of those jokes are about. Ha, ha, I'm white, da, 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 right. I can't do that. I mean, that's what that is.
Right.
But you know, it's an absence.
But that, actually, this is a kind of off my path, but mm-hmm. in terms of power, how is class working in your formulation? Mm-hmm. Because it's amazing how, you know, minstrelsy was a white working class form more than anything else for people who have their own histories of dispossession as white people and who, as Du Bois talks about, whiteness was a kind of psychological wage.
Mm-hmm.
These are people who not necessarily landowners or not necessarily have all the benefits of settler mm-hmm. Colonialism. They don't have all the benefits of being a master.
Mm-hmm.
Where do those white people fit into, you know, the formulation of the dreamers?
They have identity, but I don't think their identity, like, I think, again, if white supremacy went away today, for instance, there would still be an Appalachian identity, right? But that's different than a white, you know, an overarching white identity. And so, as I said, I think there are all sorts of, you know.
But do they receive the benefit? Certainly they receive benefits of white skin privilege, no question about this, across the board. And part of the tricky part of the story is that you tell a post-World War II story and you tell an antebellum
mm-hmm,
story.
Mm-hmm.
But just in terms of the antebellum, even postbellum story, is that element of the dreamers really benefiting in the same way
mm-hmm.
that the slave masters are benefiting? And, you know, I mean, how do we think about the psychology of whiteness for those people who have nothing else but whiteness? That's all they got.
Well, they need it more.
They need it more.
They need it more. That's obvious in our part. I'm reading this book called Citizens right now. It's like it's history of French Revolution. And there's great variety within the aristocracy, you know, as you come up. I mean, they're actually poor aristocrats, you know, mm-hmm. in France as you approach the revolution. And they're the people who cling to it the most.
Right.
I mean, because it's all they have. Literally, like, you will have situations where peasants, you know, actually are more wealthier than quote-unquote aristocrats. But these privileges are all I have.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And I haven't finished the book yet, but it's like, you know, I was working on theories. I was even reading, thinking about, I don't know how different this is from white identity. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know that one might, and again, I'm working my way through this. Somebody in the audience can tell me why I'm wrong. But you can almost see like white identity is a kind of aristocracy. You know what I mean? And you can have poor, it's like you'd have poor aristocrats. You know what I mean? You can have poor people that still have that badge.
Right.
You know, that you know, constitutes certain social privileges in this country and political privileges.
And that's what Du Bois says on Black Reconstruction.
Does he?
35, yeah.
Okay.
It's exactly. Well, let me just.
You know, I have never read that book. I'm so ashamed. I'm just gonna cop to it. I'm not gonna nod and say, yeah, he did say it.
Well, see, why you're in Paris?
I'm not gonna do that.
While you're in Paris, that should be like emergency reading.
Really?
That to me is the most important history book ever written, period.
Wow.
Yes.
Okay.
That's my students are reading it in this winter quarter. If you're here, you know. It's big. Okay, so I'm gonna skip over all. Oh, one last thing about slavery. I loved your and by the way, I'm being contentious here.
Okay.
I loved your description, pages 69-70, where you capture the humanity of the enslaved woman.
Mm-hmm.
It's beautiful. And it's very, very important because you talk about that experience of, you know, of a woman who is not a slave, but she is held in bondage, which is different. She understands. She loves the way the light falls on one particular spot in the woods. She enjoys fishing, how the water eddies in a nearby stream. It's beautiful writing. And then You make this profound observation that she is not a confirmation of the promise of American liberty, but it's a contradiction. Mm-hmm. And then you assert that, quote, for 250 years, black people were born into chains, whole generations followed by more generations who knew nothing but chains. Now, I, in principle, agree with that. Mm-hmm. But here's my question. That same enslaved woman is also one who has seen runaways, who has seen truants, who has met people born in Africa who knew freedom. Mm-hmm. In other words, mm-hmm. part of what the beauty of your description mm-hmm. is to show a fluidity and a real failure of slavery to work mm-hmm. psychologically. It may work in terms of the tongues and the muscles and the beatdowns, mm-hmm. but it doesn't work because it is the most unstable system. It's breakable. Mm-hmm. People run away constantly. The amount of money expended on security is high. You lay this out. Mm-hmm. This is actually in that book. Mm-hmm. Beautiful. So I'm wondering your thoughts about this. I mean, it's Baldwin who says that he draws from Hegel. He says, you know, the master is bound to the slave. Mm-hmm. He says he has, this is no name in the street, he has simply become the prisoner of the people he thought to cow, chain, or murder into submission mm-hmm. because he spends all his waking hours trying to maintain something that never quite works. Mm-hmm. And so this enslaved woman knows that freedom could be bought possibly by some. She knows people ran away and succeeded. She knows people ran away and failed. So how can we understand that fluidity of a system that's always so unstable? What does it tell us about what comes next? That is, how freedom's achieved.
Well, I think you raise a great philosophical question. I mean, did it fail? You know, I was listening to you. I was thinking about, you know, and I've been thinking about this a lot, like that great Thomas Jefferson quote where, you know, he describes enslavement or slavery, as he said, as having the wolf by the ears. And you can be like, he is actually, he's caught. He's caught. Like, he can't, you know, in his form, whether you buy that or not, you know. And yet, well...
But having millions of wolves by the ears.
Right.
Really. And of those millions, yeah. And some of them are like, you know, biting or getting away,
yeah.
Others are not.
Yeah.
And so then you got to figure out some kind of system to keep them by the ears.
Well, I mean, like, the question is, like, if you say the goal was to strip people of their humanity, it clearly is a failure.
Right.
I mean, but that, I think, raises a question about whether oppression ever succeeds by that term, by that definition. You know, I mean, one, I think, could argue that by that term that the Holocaust, you know, never, in fact, actually, you know, succeeded. Kids were born, you know, in the camps. You know what I mean? You had Warsaw Uprising. I mean, it was just, you know, kind of daily resistance that, you know, human beings tend to do. But I want to push back on that and resist and not become too sentimental and say, but if the goal was to extract massive amounts of wealth from other people, did it not succeed?
Right, right.
And to build the country off of that, right. I mean,
effective. No, that's not the thing I'm questioning. I'm questioning the idea of people who only know chains.
Right.
That is... born into chains.
Did they only know chains?
Did they know nothing of chains?
Right.
Because
right,
if
right.
they only knew chains, mm-hmm. then they can't possibly know the possibilities of freedom. That's
right.
And I only say that not because I disagree.
Right.
But I say it because in some ways, we sometimes you did something beautiful. That is by revealing the humanity of this enslaved mm-hmm. woman, mm-hmm. that humanity involves one other step,
right.
which you reveal indirectly,
right.
and that step is knowing that she has the capacity for freedom, and freedom is possible.
Right.
The fact that you have a free black community, it's not fully free, we
right.
know that, but the existence of a space in which enslaved people actually go into church with free black people,
right. Right.
I mean... You know, and that's all I want to throw it out to sort of get us to think about it. And I'm running out of time here, so we're going to jump to Prince Jones, and then I'm going to have you read.
Okay.
I don't want to miss Prince Jones.
Okay. No, it's very important.
Because he is a central figure in your book.
Right.
And you could talk a little bit about him. I wanted to just ask you a couple of things, and you can also riff on this. You wrote an excellent piece on Prince Jones's murder in Washington Monthly, June 2001. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned things like students protesting. Mm-hmm. You mentioned the demonstrations at the Justice Department. And I'm just curious to know, given where we are now with Black Lives Matter and other kind of protests, you didn't put too much emphasis on the demonstrations and protests and opposition in the book. And I'm wondering, is it because you're skeptical? Because they didn't really do much? What are your thoughts about?
No, I'm not. I'm not skeptical. I think I am not skeptical of the protests in the sense like they should be doing something else. Right. I'm probably skeptical of the narrative across history that protests or political activism alone on behalf of Black people can move history. One of the more depressing things for me, I mean, in this sort of, you know, like, there's a fairy tale version of the civil rights movement that people take away and they say, well, see, this shows that nonviolent, you know, revolution is possible. But in fact, I mean, I would argue that there is no moment of progress for African Americans in this country that is not shadowed by violence. Mm-hmm. And great catastrophe, in fact. certainly not the abolition of enslavement in this country. That certainly did not happen nonviolently. Black people were very, you know, much actors in that history, and they were violent actors. Right. I mean, that's just true. You know, I think by the time you get to Petersburg, you know, 1 in 8 soldiers is an African American soldier, some number like right. that. You know, you cannot envision the Union victory in the Civil War without violent Black people. It's just Absolutely. Not possible.
Yeah, and continuing to Reconstruction, same.
Right. Very much so. And the second part of, you know, and this is not, you know, I just want to distinguish this from any sort of critique of, you know, the morality of nonviolence, which I think is actually quite powerful. You know, it's quite a powerful argument. Certainly one cannot talk about the civil rights movement without seeing the long shadow of World War II, without seeing, you know, the Cold War as an embarrassment, you know, for the United States. I say all that to say that, like, absent some cataclysmic force in American life, or absent some potentially cataclysmic force in American life, I wonder how much hope there is for actual, like, real, thorough, you know, change. That does not mean that protest is futile or that protest is irrelevant because, you know, when that door opens, you know, because of something exterior that happens, somebody got to be ready to rush through. You know, if there's no protest, there's nothing that should be taken advantage of. You know, I have this, Stephen Hahn's book, A Nation Under Our Feet.
Yeah.
He tells this beautiful story of a brother, and I think he's like the first one who, you know, initiates, basically, you know, Black folks initiate this contraband policy where Black folks who escape to Union lines are deemed contraband, and by that point, they're basically liberated. Anyway, one of the first brothers that gets there, he says to, butler. General Butler, he says, I want to serve in the army. And the guy says something. He says to him, this is a white man's war. And the enslaved brother says, the free brother at that point says to Butler, you know, by the end, it'll be a Black man's war. And he goes away, he actually leaves and becomes a sailor, goes away for like 3 years, sails around the world, comes back in 1864, enlists in the 55th, the Massachusetts 55th, and his prophecy is correct. He was right.
And you know, that's in Du Bois, Black Reconstruction.
Oh, that's where you pulled that from? Really? That's where Hahn pulled that
from? It's all there.
Oh, my God.
It's all there. You're
shaming me here.
1935.
But I give that example to say, that cat had to be ready.
Right.
You know, he had, now something outside his control happened that, you know, enabled him, but he had to be right. So I don't think the point, you know, is that, you know, these folks, you know, in Black Lives Matter, you know, what they're doing is futile. I don't take that away at all. But, we are in a situation that unless the broader country sees its own interests here, sees the interests of its children, sees the interests of its grandchildren, its great-great-grandchildren, I'm worried. I'm worried. And I guess what worries me more, and, you know, Robin, you can speak to this, I don't know of countries or states or societies seeing their long-term interests absent some great cataclysm, like just out of benevolence or, you know, superior morality. I just, I mean, I don't see that. Mm-hmm. I really, really don't see that. I mean, it's one of the reasons why the book, you know, sort of ends on climate change, you know, as a thing outside of our control, you know?
Yeah, but see, that's one of my favorite moments in the mm-hmm. book, because in some ways, what better example of plunder,
right,
as Baldwin talks about, as a global
right.
process,
right,
than climate change.
Right, right.
And in fact, this brings me, actually, no, I can't. I don't have time to talk about it, but I just wanted to, I was going to press you on some other things about democracy and legislation and the Prince Jones. By the way, before you read, this is a very sobering thought, but, you know, in 2006, the county, PG County, actually settled with yeah. Prince's daughter,
right.
The mother of his child, and then Prince Jones Sr.
Right.
And Mabel Jones, of course, didn't settle. No. Now, they got like $4.6 million. Mm-hmm. There are some people who are in movements now who will say, well, that's not justice, but it's some acknowledgement. Clearly, I think we could agree that's not justice. But what are your thoughts? If someone were to say to you, well, you know, there was no admission of wrongdoing, but they got paid.
No, that's totally not. No, not right. at all. And here's why. There's a reason why it says the state versus.
Mm-hmm.
obviously, you know, the killing of Prince Jones was a great offense, you know, to his family, but it was an offense to the society.
Right.
It was an offense to the society, and it was not just a, you know, they did something to it. It had, you know, reverberations
right.
across the board. And so it really is on behalf of the people that justice should have been done, and that did not happen.
Right.
That did not happen. So no, it's not. I mean, and it's the thing that, you know, we're seeing this across the board with police brutality cases. I mean, New York, you know, I think it's paid out some record number, you know, suits. PG County at that time had paid out some ridiculous right. numbers of suits, but that is not justice because, you know, basically, it's this deformed system wherein the citizenry can't get a handle on the police, or the political class, you know, continues to pass policies that sends the police out into these situations. And effectively what we do is paying off these civil suits is a cost of doing business.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just kind of factored in. But the policy never changes, right. you know? And no, that's not, that don't do it at all.
Right.
That don't
no, do it. I completely agree. I just know how some people think. There are some people who consider themselves activists around this question,
yeah.
who are like, well, you know, have them pay, but it's not about money.
No. I don't think it's even about putting right. an officer in jail. It's about a change in policy.
Right, right.
You know, it has to go beyond that.
Okay, so I had one more question that I'm going to save. So let's see. I know you want to share some of the book about your moving to New York for the first time, which...
Okay.
You know.
So this is just after we came to New York, and it's me addressing my son. We lived in a basement apartment in Brooklyn, which I doubt you remember, down the street from your Uncle Ben and his wife, your Aunt Janae. These were not great times. I remember borrowing $200 from Ben and it feeling like a million. I remember your grandfather coming to New York, taking me out for Ethiopian, after which I walked him to the West 4th subway station. We said our goodbyes and walked away. He called me back. He had forgotten something. He handed me a check for $120. I tell you this because you must understand, no matter the point of our talk, that I didn't always have things, but I had people. I always had people. I had a mother and father who I would match against any other. I had a brother who looked out for me all through college. I had the Mecca that directed me. I had friends who would leap in front of a bus for me. You need to know that I was loved, that whatever my lack of religious feeling, I have always loved my people. And that broad love is directly related to the specific love I feel for you. I remember sitting out on Ben's stoop on Friday nights, drinking Jack Daniels, debating the mayor's race or the rush to war. My weeks felt aimless. I pitched to various magazines with no success. Your Aunt Shauna lent me another $200. I burned it all on a scam bartending school. I delivered food for a small deli in Park Slope. In New York, everyone wanted to know your occupation. I told people that I was trying to be a writer. Some days I would take the train into Manhattan. there was so much money everywhere. Money flowing out of bistros and cafes. Money pushing the people at incredible speeds up the wide avenues. Money drawing intergalactic traffic through Times Square. Money in the limestones and brownstones. Money out on West Broadway, where white people spilled out of wine bars with sloshing glasses and without police. I would see these people at the club, drunken, laughing, challenging breakdancers to battles. They would be destroyed and humiliated in these battles, but afterward, they would give dap, laugh, order more beers. They were utterly fearless. I did not understand it until I looked out on the street. That was where I saw white parents pushing double-wide strollers down gentrifying Harlem boulevards in T-shirts and jogging shorts. Or I saw them lost in conversation with each other, mother and father, while their sons commanded entire sidewalks with their tricycles. The galaxy belonged to them. And as terror was communicated to our children, I saw mastery communicated to theirs. And so when I remember pushing you and your stroller to other parts of the city, the West Village, for instance, almost instinctively believing that you should see more, I remember feeling ill at ease. I had borrowed someone's heirloom, like I was traveling under an assumed name. All this time, you were growing into words and feelings, my beautiful brown boy, who would soon come into knowledge, who would soon comprehend the edicts of his galaxy and all the extinction level of events that regarded you with a singular and discriminating interest. You would be a man one day, and I could not save you from the unbridgeable distance between you and your future peers and colleagues who might try to convince you that everything I know, all the things I'm sharing with you here, are an illusion or a fact of a distant past that need not be discussed. And I could not save you from the police, from their flashlights, their hands, their nightsticks, their guns. Prince Jones, murdered by the men who should have been his security guards, is always with me. And I knew that soon he would be with you. In those days, I would come out of the house, turn onto Flatbush Avenue, and my face would tighten like a Mexican wrestler's mask. My eyes would dart from corner to corner, my arms loose, limber, and ready. This need to be always on guard was an unmeasured expenditure of energy, the slow siphoning of the essence. It contributed to the fast breakdown of our bodies. So I feared not just the violence of this world, but the rules designed to protect you from it, the rules that would have you contort your body to address the block, and contort again to be taken seriously by colleagues, and contort again so as not to give the police a reason. All my life, I'd heard people tell their black boys and black girls to be twice as good, which is to say, accept half as much. These words would be spoken with a veneer of religious nobility, as though they evidenced some unspoken quality, some undetected courage, when in fact all they evidenced was the gun to our head and the hand in our pocket. This is how we lose our softness. This is how they steal our right to smile. No one told those little white children with their tricycles to be twice as good. I imagine their parents telling them to take twice as much. It seemed to me that our own rules redoubled the plunder. It struck me that perhaps the defining feature of being drafted into the black race was the inescapable robbery of time, because the moments we spent readying the mask or readying ourselves to accept half as much could not be recovered. The robbery of time is not measured in lifespans, but in moments. It is the last bottle of wine that you have just uncorked but do not have time to drink. It is the kiss you do not have time to share before she walks out of your life. It is the raft of second chances for them and 23-hour days for us.
Okay. So we're about to take questions, but we got, let me get 1 minute.
Okay.
Two questions.
Sure.
One question is, when you say struggle, that all you have really to give, the struggle is really all I have for you, Tessa Maury, what do you mean by struggle? And then the second question is top five.
I'm going to defer on the last question. I can't, it's so hard. And the older I get, it's very hard to like, I mean, what do you, you know what I mean? Because things change for you. It's very, very hard for me to do that. I love Black Thought. I can't rank these guys, but it's just who I love right now. I love Black Thought. I love Rakim. I love Chuck D. I love Kendrick Lamar. And you know, I don't know. Did I name Raekwon? I love Raekwon. Okay, but that should not be regarded as exclusive to anybody else. You ask me something tomorrow, and I might tell you something else. You know, on a personal level, the constant effort to, you know, it's amazing how American this is. You can't get away from your country. The constant effort to improve yourself, you know, which I think is a very, very real thing, despite, you know, whatever is going on around you. And then on a broader level, being involved in this beautiful epic that stretches back to the moment that we arrived on these shores to improve our communities, to improve our country, and to ultimately improve the human race itself, to advance democracy. That is the beauty of Black folks' struggle in this country. It is not, you know, people used to ask, they said, well, you don't want to get boxed off. You know, you don't want to get pigeonholed for writing about race. I said, you're completely wrong. You're completely wrong. It is an honor to write about this. It is an absolute honor, because if you wanted to understand what the promise was, and what the pitfalls were of this whole idea of enlightenment, of this whole idea of democracy, I mean, the crucial questions of humanity today, you could pick no better angle than to study Black people in America. It's the best, it is not a pigeonhole. It is the essence of everything. It's a great place to be.
Well, the argument that it's a pigeonhole is exactly the Enlightenment philosophy. That's exactly how it plays it. You know? Okay, so now we'll take some questions. And by the way, we're taking questions, one question, not three questions, no statements, no resumes, no promises of jobs, and I will cut you off. I'll come down there and cut you off.
I've got the first question right over here.
Okay, one question.
Hi, thanks so much for coming. Now that you're living in France, do you still feel that racism is less pervasive there?
No, I never felt racism was less pervasive in France. I felt that I, as an African-American, had a different interaction with French society than I, as an African-American, had with American society. But that says nothing about the people of color, the Black folks, the Maghrebins, who live in France, and their interaction with the society, which is completely, completely different. I think that, like, when I'm there, the first thing people notice about me is that I'm an American. And that is a very, very different experience for me. It's one that I can't really have in my own country. So that is interesting and in particular, but that is by no means exonerating.
Right.
You know, at all. And I think both things can be true at the same time. I mean, you'll hear, like, Black folks, although I think it's to a different degree, but you'll hear Black folks, you know, from the continent or from the Caribbean, and their interaction with America is very, very different than mine is. You know, that's a real thing, you know, but that is not exonerating of America either,
right.
You know, so I don't hold those two ideas in contradiction.
Yeah, and you address that in the book as well.
Yeah.
In fact, it's a great quote where Baldwin and Farnik Sam says, you know, that the Tunisians in 1956 were correct when they asked the French, are you ready for self-government?
Right, exactly.
Think about that. Okay, next question.
So I'm really excited for you to take on the Black Panther. And I'm wondering, what are you going to bring to the world of comic books and the possibility of comic books through the Black Panther?
I don't know. I mean, you know what? Honestly, that'll be for you to tell when you read the book. It really will. I mean, I'm trying really hard not to suck. And that's like my basic standard. You know, and you know, to be honest, truly, I am. This is not false modesty. That was the standard for Between the World and Me. You have to understand that, like, whenever you embark on something as a writer, you might fail. Like, and that's what you're thinking about. Like, you think about, like, this might not work, and so the immediate thing is not, I'm gonna write this book that is gonna change how people see race and racism in America. No, I'm trying to write a book. If I can just make it a book, like I said, you know, like you have to actually grapple with the form before you can even, you know, and it's kind of the same. I mean, I've never written a comic book in my life. I'm just trying to be successful at writing a comic book. And then we can have, you know, all sorts of discussions, or you guys can have all sorts of discussions about, you know, what impact it has. But do not underestimate the difficulty of just telling a story. You know, that in and of itself is hard.
That's true. Who's next? Yes.
Yes. Greetings, brothers.
Hi.
Nice to meet you both. My question is prefaced with a comment. I grew up. I grew up at 221 North Fremont Avenue in Baltimore, Maryland. Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Tioga Park, where across the street from Mondawmin Mall.
Give thanks. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you too.
Uh-huh.
That was my question.
Oh. That was it.
So, what can white people do?
Right, but see, that's the whole purpose of the book. That is so not for me to say.
Right.
That's the exact point. And in fact, like, the argument of the book is that those are the kind of questions that should not be asked. Because, and I mean this as no offense to you. I hope you don't take this the wrong way. But you are putting your burden onto me. Like, I have to now propose to you, you know, what you should do. I mean, it is, I think you know. And I think if you thought about it, like, you, it would not be that hard to get to. You know what I mean? I believe that, you know? Black people have enough trouble figuring out how to get through their lives on a daily basis without, you know, having to figure out what white people should do. You know? And I'm not trying to embarrass you. I'm not trying to humiliate you. I'm not, you know what I mean? But that really is the impetus of the book, to try to get away from the notion that the job, frankly, of black thinkers, of black, and I hate this word, black public intellectuals, black writers, is to make white people not be racist. Like, that's not actually our job. Like, that is against what I think actually needs to happen, which is to recognize your own interests. And when you recognize, you know, anti-racism, you know, anti-white supremacy as an interest, when you recognize the need to give up your name as an interest, you know, you just start walking down the road. You know what I mean? And things, you know, begin to reveal themselves. White people, as I say in the book, the people who believe themselves to be white, you know, as Baldwin said, you know, the people who think they are white, have to carry that themselves. They have to carry, you know, that burden of their own ignorance. Just like we have to carry our burden. I mean, that is what it means to get down in the muck with us. That is what it means to come down here into this world of not knowing, you know? And I hope that's tangible for you. I you know what I mean? That is, like, I think, like, the real first step to not ask questions, to ask those questions of yourself. Okay.
Thank you both for coming tonight. I've been a teacher in Los Angeles for 15 years, and my question is, what... You know, you mentioned in the book that for you, school was not a place about curiosity, but a place for compliance. And so I wonder, is there a place for schools in this movement, and in particular for teachers of black students?
Well, I mean, I don't know. I don't know. School specifically, the classroom, was not how I acquired knowledge. It just was too abstract for me. One of the cool things about writing and going into journalism was you acquired the knowledge, you went and wrote something, you did, it was a practical thing. And I don't know, I guess if I could have identified the pursuit of knowledge with what was happening in the classroom, like, maybe, like, I would have felt better, but it was so clear that, and you see this, I mean, in this, you know, in schools today, and particularly in schools where, you know, poor and African-American populations are, they really are teaching compliance. I mean, don't talk unless you're called on, you know, walk on, you know, this side of the room, single file, da-da-da-da. I mean, that whole routine, which, if you go to, you know, private schools or you go to public schools in very wealthy areas, it is amazing how unimportant that same compliance is. It's fascinating. You know, I walked my son, you know, for middle school, you know, he was in private school. And now, even in the public school he was in, which was very tailored in a certain way, I would go into the classroom and it looked like disorder to me because of how I had been raised. But in fact, it was not, you know, disorder. You know, what it was an absence of fear. I mean, that really was what it was. You know, it was not, you know, under the same sort of pressures and stresses. So I don't know. I mean, obviously there is a place,
but it's not the place I come from. But you answered the question by basically saying that schools are actually an urgent space. That's what I'm taking from what you're saying, an urgent space to struggle over. That, in fact, we don't want to create compliance. You don't want to turn, because schools have become miniature versions of prisons, right? And so they're preparing the way. And we know from the research that from fourth grade is when you're determined whether or not you're going to go to prison or college, right? So we have to struggle. I mean, this is exactly the point that I think Ta-Nehisi's making, that schools are important sites of contestation, and we've got to basically destroy them to rebuild them, you know? And if you ever want to read someone on this, Grace Lee Boggs, who just passed away, wrote beautiful essays. She wrote a book called The Next American Revolution, which she talks about, you know, remaking our schools, not to learn to teach people how to become workers, but to basically teach people how to become a part of a larger community. You know, and that's where we're going. And again, you read The Beautiful Struggle, you get to see both the problems and the prospects. Because I have to just throw this out here. I know I'm taking up your time, but
I'm good.
But
I'm all right.
But in The Beautiful Struggle, part of Ta-Nehisi had this great education through Nation House, an education that brought him to the drum, that brought him to certain cultural practices, that brought him to different communities, and I think was very much a part of your education in an enriching way that schools never could provide. Mm-hmm. Anyway.
So I love your book. It's amazing and it's so poetic. But my question to you is, do you ever feel when you're writing this book, as you're displaying the humanity of African American people, does it ever just piss you off that you have to have that conversation, that this is a book that's necessary to write?
Not while I'm writing it, because I think like what writers are supposed to write about humanity anyway. I mean, that would be the job no matter what. I get a little, I've been a little rankled, and I probably should not be rankled, but after the work of writing the book was fine. After the book came out, the weight put upon it was not so fun. And again, like I think, like if you're looking at it from the outside, what you see is like a person sitting down and saying, "I'm going to write the best book on race this year, and it's going to do this, and it's going to do that, and everyone will read it, and it's going to be." And I don't see you just sitting down, like looking at the blank page and just afraid. Like just actually, like the creative process is so obscured that, you know, people feel like it's a handbook or that it's an advice book or that's even a policy book. And if it's not any of those things, that it's useless. That is disturbing, you know, or that it's, you know, like beautiful writing in the service of something else, but I have to be honest with you. I mean, my goal and how I saw it is beautiful writing in the service of beautiful writing. I mean, I was trying to make a piece of art. That's what I was trying to do. And so some of the stuff put on it, if I could just live in that world of humanity, it'd be fine, you know?
Hey, thank you for your art. I've heard a lot of the two words, black and white, and as a Dominican man currently living in Hollywood, born in New York, lived in Queens, hung out in the Bronx, did it all. I often find myself struggling with my own cultural identity because I can play both sides, per se. And in Hollywood, people like to say, oh, you're ethnically ambiguous, you're so lucky. And that's something that makes me want to throw open my mouth sometimes because that's why I'm lucky. I want to know in this conversation, where does the middle fall? Where do those other cultures fall?
Well, I think when you're talking about black and white, so I'm going to say something very, very not politic. One of the problems in this country is that, and this is, you know, Between the World and Me argues against this, is the notion of race is a real thing. Okay, and so just let me just take a second. I'm sorry, I'm going to have to take a moment to break this down just a little bit, but I think it's really, really important. The idea that black people, this pure race of people that come from Africa, and white people is this pure race of people who come from Europe. Native Americans is this pure race of people living here. Asian Americans, this pure race of people who come from Asia, and increasingly Hispanics and Latinos, is this race that, you know, is here now. And we have this span, right? And we have, you know, this group, these races, these people of color, and then white people, you know, sort of over here. And if we could get the races to get along, everything would be okay. And that's actually in our vocabulary. For instance, the phrase race relations. The race is a real thing, and we need to improve the relations between the group of people. But, you know, my argument is that race is a product of racism, period. There is no race without race. There is no definition of race without, in America, without somebody trying to do something to somebody else. And when you talk about race, you know, as a power thing in America, black people are the great insoluble. The black race is the black race, you know, as it's defined, is the great insoluble. The chasm that exists between what we refer to as white America and what we refer to as black America is a particular thing. It is not something that can be sort of just mixed in, you know, with people who just, you know, with some group of people who just don't happen to be straight, white, rich males. This is a particular fault line. And the problem is not, you know, not looking, you know, white. Like, do you understand? Like, the problem is not being a part of, you know, a group of people who can't, you know, necessarily trace their ancestry back to Europe, because the fact of the matter is quite a few of us can actually trace our ancestry back to Europe if you want to be honest about it. The problem is power. And black racial identity is a specific thing, like where that plays in politics. And so I don't know that, like I say, a Latino identity, a Hispanic identity, a Dominican identity, however you want, is like, I wouldn't define that as a middle, actually, because I don't think it is. I just don't see it that way. I think that's like an ethnic cultural identity, much like black people have ethnic cultural identity. I think race is put on that, you know, through racism, by the way. I don't think it has any meaning without racism, but I would resist the terminology of a kind of middle. I think it's very, very important. Like, if, for instance, if I were analyzing it from that perspective, I'd be much more interested in, you know, the history of Latinos, as Hispanics, Dominicans, as I say, however you want to define it, and their relation to the larger group of people, not as a middle group, you know, on a range, you know, because I don't think that quite gets it.
We're going to take one more question, but I gotta respond to this. I just want to say one thing. What is racism? Ta-Nehisi is saying it's a production of difference. It's a production of difference. So being Dominican right now is interesting in relationship to deportation of Haitians, right? Where the production of difference, and you're talking about people who occupy the same island, but one is considered an inferior race. That's produced in power. That's not about some distinct, you know, historical culture, but specifically the production of power and difference. And so here's a perfect, I mean, Dominican Republic is the perfect example of what Ta-Nehisi is talking about. That is, you know, in relationship to notions of white supremacy, you got the production of those who are considered of a lower inferior race who are then being pushed out through administrative form in ways that are very dangerous. And as you know, Junot Diaz just had his medal sort of taken away by Dominican Republic, which is a travesty. We should all be up in arms about that.
Right.
But that's an example of race. We confuse culture and race. You
and
know?
Can I just, in fact, I just want to push this further. Like, and Robin, I hope you won't take this the wrong way, but like, why isn't Robin the middle? I mean, think about this. Like, why isn't Robin the, and I'm not saying you should be, but he isn't. He isn't. I'm going to tell you why. But he isn't the middle, right?
Right.
He isn't the middle,
exactly.
Because we made a decision about power in this country.
Right.
And we decided to, you know, draw the line, you know, somewhere so that as many people as possible could be plundered.
Right.
That's why he's not the middle. It's because we made a conscious decision. It's not a, you know, a kind of, you know, a biological or scientific anything. You know, I mean, there are black people who look just like you. You know what I mean? Who are very much, you know, African American. That was a decision that was made. And so the places, you know, where you
exactly.
know, you would say, you know, in middle, they can't be divided from the issue, you know, of power and politics.
Right. One last question. Who is it going to be? Okay.
Okay, I'm feeling a lot of pressure, it being the last question.
Make it good.
You know, I have about 200 questions I'd like to ask you both.
Pick the best.
this is why I'm under pressure. I was very interested when you were speaking about whether or not there's a responsibility to have hope as a writer in your writing. And another thing that you were talking about was Malcolm X. And when I was growing up, Malcolm X was demonized. And demonized, I think, by the usual suspects, either whites or Elijah Muhammad or whatever.
Yeah. You come straight to the question, because we got the context.
Well, there's context, and I will come to it.
Okay, we don't need context.
Okay. So now what seems to have happened is that there is the Malcolm X, there is hope that has been basically written into the Malcolm X story in terms of, you know, going to Mecca and
right.
really...
Okay. We all know that. So what's the question exactly?
Okay. You know what? My question is whether or not you can add some context to how it is, who it is, that was basically changing the tenor of the history of Malcolm X.
Well, I think that happens to everybody. You know, it happened to Martin Luther King, too, by the way.
Right.
You know, I think when people are dead, you know, and they aren't, you know, saying certain things and they aren't making certain speeches, and they achieve a level of respect in society, there's always urge to co-opt them and take, you know, from them whatever you can. And I think Malcolm is no different than that. I think it happened the same thing with Martin. I mean, everybody wants to talk about the I Have a Dream speech. Very few people want to talk about the Vietnam speech. Mm-hmm. You know, so. No. I think people in general do that. I mean, I don't think, the challenge is, no. I think it is a natural process that people, you know, are softening at their edges, scraped off. I don't find that to be particularly original for Malcolm.
Right. Well, I'll tell you, you can learn a lot from reading this book and reading all of Ta-Nehisi's work. So I want to thank you all for coming. Thank you, Ta-Nehisi, for doing this.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you all. Thank you. Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.